This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
Thank you. What is a drakina? Of course, it is, in the most basic sense, the feminine and female denoting reflex of the familiar masculine term dracone, dragon. This term in itself is a hard one to define, but I've come to settle on a large, sometimes gargantuan, snake and something more. This more sometimes being physical, but almost always being supernatural. And here we have the Colchis dracone on the left. He has a little additional part there, he has a beard. And likewise, this is the on the right, you have the dracone of Ares, as Cadmus killing it with a stone. And he has not only a little beard, but also a little crest. Now let's turn to dracina, our subject today. The word dracina is attested in use 103 times before the fall of Constantinople, TLG tells me. There's some double counting there for book fragments, of course. An indication of the word's obscurity is in the fact that its most common context is the works of the grammarians. From the 2nd century AD onwards, at least, scholars took an interest in its morphological relationship with its masculine counterpart, dracone, and in the analogy of this relationship with relationships between a list of further pairs of masculine-feminine, male-denoting, female-denoting nouns, in primis, laon, laina, therapone, therapina, and lacone, lacina. The dracina-liaina jangle was a compelling one for Greek authors more widely, with a number of them bringing the terms together in various different contexts. Now, many uses of the term dracina seem to signify, in the first instance, a creature of more or less pure serpentine form. So far as I'm aware, the only attempt to mark the gender of a pure serpent dracina in art falls in some portrait pairs of the house-protecting serpents Agathos Daimon and Agathaire Toucair. Here, the serpent beard that normally serves as an optional marker of supernature seemingly reverts to being a differentiator of gender. However, of the many uses of the term dracina ostensibly to denote a pure serpent in the first instance, the great majority of them are imbued in some way with a notion of the female humanoid form too. Most often, it was applied to creatures specifically adduced as metaphors for, or comparanda for, human women or humanoid women. The obvious suspects: Circe, Clytemnestra, Delilah, Salome, and courtesans. But sometimes it was more particularly applied to female anguipedes, monsters that consisted primarily of a humanoid upper half and a serpentine lower half, a la Typhon and Cecrops in the male register. And I suspect that this would have been the primary image the word would have conjured up in the mind of your average ancient Greek in the street. It is this use that our interest follows here, and have seven examples to talk about, beginning with the echidna. These bits of art are just decorative, by the way. The first of our great anguipedes is the echidna, or just echidna, viper, who manifests herself in diverse ways in diverse texts. She arrives first in the Theogony. The term dracina is not applied to her here, but her anguipede form is clearly explained. And she, probably Cato, a notorious problem, and she, Cato, bore another irresistible monster, nothing like mortal men or the immortal gods, in a hollow cave, the divine, strong-minded echidna, who in half of her body is a nymph, with rolling eyes and fair cheeks, but in the other half is a monstrous snake in office, terrible and great, darting, eating raw flesh or mare stairs, deep in hidden lairs in the sacred earth. There is her cave down below, under a hollow rock, far from the immortal gods and mortal men. There the gods allocated to her a glorious home in which to dwell, and the baleful echidna keeps watch under the earth in Arima, wherever that is, an immortal nymph, unaging all her days. They say that Typhon was joined with her in love, the terrible, violent and lawless creature, joined with the nymph of rolling eyes. She conceived and bore strong-minded children. That's the Theogony 295 to 308. Hesiod goes on to list the monstrous offspring, partly anguiform, that this brood mother bears to Typhon. Orthus, he of the serpent tail. Cerberus, he of the serpent tail and often the shaggy serpent coat. The Hydra, no explanation needed. The Chimaera and the Sphinx, both serpent-tailed creatures. And the Nemean lion, no serpent there, as far as I can tell. Herodotus then gives us an echidna encountered by Heracles in Cilicia. She steals his horses and will only return them to him when he slept with her so that she can acquire 3 children from him. The broodmother motif again. Herodotus describes her as a half-maiden, a double-formed echidna. In the Frogs of 405 BC, Aristophanes has Aeacus threaten Dionysus, who's masquerading as Heracles, with a number of underworld terrors, including 100-headed echidna, who will tear your guts apart. Is this supposedly the same echidna as Hesiod's? The detail of the 100 heads is strongly reminiscent of Hesiod's description of his echidna's consort, Typhon. Accordingly, we may be invited to construe Aristophanes' echidna's overall form on the same model as Typhon. He has a humanoid torso, and his 100 snake heads branch from his shoulders, but Hesiod probably imagined him also to be an anguipede, as he is shown in archaic art. We saw him there on the right. Finally, we have the splendid echidna, who presides over the gloriously overwrought serpentine horrors of Ophiorymi, Snake Town, and its environs in the Acts of Philip of circa 400 AD. You must read this text. She recalls her Hesiodic forebear in her eventual fate, which is to be swallowed up into the underworld abyss. This in response to the saints' prayers, of course. Unlike her classical forebears, however, this echidna is given no explicit physical description, but she is explicitly defined as a drakina. Not only that, she's also described as the mother of snakes, in yet another occurrence of the broodmother motif. Delphine. A minor variant of the Python tradition made the serpent that Apollo killed at Delphi rather a female one, Delphine. It is in connection with her that we find the earliest recorded use of the term drakina in the Homeric hymn to Apollo, shortly after 590 BC, in this bit of it. Nearby was the sweetly flowing spring, where Lord Apollo, the son of Zeus, killed the drakina, shooting from his stout bow. She was fat and huge, a wild monster, who did much harm to people on the earth, much harm to people themselves, and much to slender-footed sheep, for she was a blood-reeking bane. So the Homeric hymn to Apollo 309. According first to 3rd century BC sources, Callimachus and Meandrius, if that was his name, this Delphic drakina, the mythical alternate to the eventually more famous Draco and Python, was called Delphine. More to the point, according to Apollodorus, this drakina Delphine was an anguipede. At 163 of the Bibliotheca, he tells us. Similarly, he, Typhon, put away the sinews of Zeus there in a cave, hiding them in the skin of a bear, and he set the drakina Delphine as guard over them. The maiden was a half-beast, a hamey thayer. Was Delphine an anguipede already for the Homeric hymn to Apollo? It's hard to say. The description, fat and huge, might be thought to fit a pure serpent form slightly better, but that's not a very decisive point, I think. Already in the poem, she has an association with Typhon as his former nurse, which makes us think of the other great female serpent associated with Typhon in early poetry, Echidna. His explicitly angry peak consort in the Theogony, whom we've already discussed. Ah, sorry, there's a picture, there's a nice picture of Python for you. Not I'm sorry to say, Delphine. Although in some versions of this picture you can see sort of a nice eyelashes there, but I'm sure it's Python. This is a drawing of a lost vase, long lost. I mean, this drawing was made by Tischbein. And as always in these cases, one wonders whether the original pot ever existed. I'm pretty sure it does. I'm sorry, I digress here. It's a little obsession of mine. Because you see the two babies that Leto is... this is a python harassing Leto with her two babies, Apollo and Artemis. And the two babies you see are... well, you would think they're just, you know, stretching out saying, you know, what a baby wants to cuddle a cute dragon. but no, in fact, they were holding bows and arrows, which have since been lost. I assume they were put on with a white slip, which can often, as fine details often were, this melts away. So I think actually that particular mistake, I think, proves the genuineness of the image, which is good to know, because images of Python, important as he was, are so rare, and this is really the only good one, apart from his sort of integration as a sort of minor attribute in statues and things. Anyway, there we go. Right, Harmonia. At the end of Euripides' Bacchae, Cadmus foresees his own and his wife Harmonia's eventual fate to be turned into serpents, possibly in compensation for his slaying of the Dracoon of Ares, whom we saw before. At the end of the Bacchae, he says, I will lead my wife Harmonia, the daughter of Ares, against Greek altars and tombs. I will be a Dracoon. She will have the form of a wild Dracaena. There's Cadmus again with the Dracoon, killing the Dracoon. Nice Etruscan alabaster funerary urn there. There's a fair case that both Cadmus and Harmonia were conceptualised as being transformed not into pure serpents, but into angripedes. Philostratus gives us an ekphrasis of a fantasy painting of the final scene of the Bacchae, which includes the final transformation foreshadowed here as a decorative detail, Imagines 1:8. They are becoming serpents up to their thighs, and they are already covered in scales. Gone are their feet, gone are their buttocks, and the transformation of their form is creeping up their bodies. They are astonished and embrace each other as if trying to hold on to what remains of their bodies so as not to be deprived of them. It's not clear, and perhaps Philostratus leaves it deliberately vague, whether the transformation will indeed progress up the entirety of their bodies, or whether they will be left as angripedes. Also relevant here is a fragment from an unidentified tragedy of Euripides, which describes a similar sort of transformation, and almost certainly refers to Cadmus again. Alas, half of me becomes a Dracoon child. Embrace what is left of your father. Hecate. In her earliest identifiable portrait, that of an Attic Lekythos of around 470 BC, Hecate is shown as an angripede with, additionally, a pair of dogs projecting forth from her midriff, winningly engaged in the tearing apart of a human soul between them. So it can be a little difficult to construe this image. So here we have the central upright female form. This is the coiling serpent tail. Okay, and there's one doggy, there's the other doggy. And here is the human soul being torn apart between them. It's to die for, isn't it? An Aristophanes fragment then speaks of Hecate of the Earth, Chthonia, rolling coils of snakes, which similarly seems to describe an angripede. But the most striking literary description of an angripede Hecate comes to us in Lucian's Philopseudes, a favourite text of mine, as some may know. I saw a fearsome woman approaching me, almost half a stadium's length high. In her left hand she held a torch, and in her right a sword 20 cubits long. Below the waist she had a snake foot. Above it, she resembled a Gorgon, so far as concerns the look in her eyes and her terrible appearance, I mean. Instead of hair, writhing snakes fell down in curls around her neck, and some of them coiled over her shoulders. The goddess's dogs were taller than Indian elephants, similarly black and shaggy, with dirty matted hair. Anyway, when I saw her, I came to a halt, and at the same time turned back the seal ring that the Arab had given me to the inside of my finger. In other words, he has a magic ring on, and he turns the stone to the inside of his hand to activate it. Hecate stamped on the ground with her snake foot, her Drakonteoi podi, and created a huge chasm as deep as Tartarus. Presently, she jumped into it and was gone. So again, the angry peat woman ends up back in the hole in the ground. The hair aside, this Hecate is a perfect match for the Lekythos. A Sophocles fragment had previously spoken of Hecate as garlanded with oak and the twisted coils of savage Dracontes. Sophocles may have been thinking literally here in terms of a headband made of snakes, asported by certain versions of the Erinyes, as we'll see below, or he may be speaking more indirectly of the Gorgonian snaky hairs found here. So far, so good, but what of Hecate as a Dracaena? In the hymn to Hecate Selene, in PGM 4, from the 4th century AD, the great magical papyrus in Paris, the goddess is given the epithet Dracaena amongst a blizzard of others, in immediate context. Horse, maiden, corair, Dracaena, torch, lightning bolt, star, lion, she-wolf. Similarly, in the magical recipe detailed in PGM 70, the spellmaker is told to address Hecate Ereshkigal in the following terms: Ereshkigal, virgin, Dracaena, garland, key, herald staff, golden sandal of the Tartarus holder. Don't ask. In both cases, the latter part of the list becomes a little surreal, but the adjacent terms of virgin and Dracaena are at any rate compatible with the conceptualisation of Hecate as an anguipede. The Furies. The term Dracaena is applied at a much earlier stage to Hecate's close associates, the Furies or Erinyes. In Aeschylus's Eumenides, 458 BC, the ghost of Clytemnestra observes that the work of the Furies pursuing Orestes has been undermined by weariness. Sleep and labour have exhausted the might of the dread Dracaena. The ghost also notes that they resemble Gorgons and that their cry resembles that of hunting dogs. These details evoke an image similar to that of the early anguipede Hecate, and more particularly to Lucian's Hecate, who also sports snake hair. In Euripides' Iphigenia in Tauris of 414 to 12 BC, Orestes is quoted as describing an attack of the Erinyes to Pylades in the following terms: Pylades, have you seen this dog-faced woman? Do you not see how this Dracaena of Hades, edged or fringed, estomomene, with dread echidnae, vipers, wants to kill me? Beside her, another one beats her wings, breathing fire and blood. Dog faces and a fringe of serpents. Almost certainly, Euripides also has in mind here a configuration compatible with that of Lucian's Hecate, though the term fringed may just be compatible with a snake garland too. Compatibly, in Orestes, Euripides describes the Erinyes as bloody-faced dracontordes, corai, serpent-like maidens. However, the anguipede configuration was not the most popular one for the Erinyes. In the Coephory, Aeschylus affirms that their bodies are thickly entwined with Dracontes. This seems to imply that the Erinyes are fully humanoid females with attendant serpents coiling around them. Similarly, in Euripides' Electra, we are told that Athene will ward off the Erinyes with their Dracontes, and also that they have snakes twining around their arms, Cheirod Dracontes. And this is the way in which they were predominantly to be represented in art, as we see already in the second iconographic document for the Erinyes, another Attic Lekythos, this one dated to 460 to 50 BC. Lamia. We now turn to a fascinating but slippery series of creatures, and they have to be slippery, wouldn't they, in whom I believe the anguipede model lurks, although the term Drakina is not in practice applied to them in any of the sources extant. Lamias. The Lamias are very tricky creatures. The bulk of the ancient source tradition builds the following picture. Lamia had once been a beautiful Libyan queen, a daughter of Belos, i.e. Baal or Baal. And she was seduced by Zeus. An envious Hera killed the children she bore, whereupon she was somehow transformed, through her own envy in turn, into a child-killing, sometimes child-devouring demon, with the ability to remove her own unsleeping eyes. It is sometimes indicated that there was not merely one Lamia demon, but many. Singular or plural, Lamias were used as bogies by mothers to frighten their children and keep them in line. But I wish here to draw attention to the rather neglected, sometimes serpentine, aspect of this creature. In this regard, we have four striking case studies, all of them, alas, problematic. In Statius' wonderful account of Choroibus of Argos, I'm sorry, I know the words Statius and wonderful don't come together very often. In Statius' wonderful account of Choroibus of Argos, and the foundation of Tripodiski, Delphic Apollo punishes Argos for the death of his son Linus by sending a terrible monster against the city. Choroibus kills the monster and is instructed by the god to found the city of Tripodiski in recompense. The monster is explicitly described as an anguipede, with a maiden torso and a snaky bottom half, but she also has a serpent head rising out of the top of her humanoid one. In addition to this, she has claw-like hands with talons on which she skewers the babies of the Argives. Again, what's not to love? A creature of precisely this form, standing before an Apollo, seated on the Omphalos with his lyre, is illustrated on a Lekythos, wrongly, I contend, identified by Limke as depicting Python. Really? Statius does not apply the term Lamia to his creature, but she is eventually described in this way by the first Vatican mythographer, Citrodera Dignum Est. In his fifth oration, Dio Chrysostom speaks of a marvellous race of creatures infesting the Libyan Syrtes. They have the upper halves of maidens and the bottom half of serpents, save that these bottom halves culminate not in tails but in serpent heads, as if they were one-legged anguipede giants, if we refer back to the images we saw earlier. Like Statius's monster, they have great claw-like hands. Their modus operandi is to conceal the bulk of their bodies and their serpent heads behind sand dunes, and then wave their naked female humanoid end above at passing tasty young men. As the young men run towards them, why wouldn't they? They wheel around, grab them in their claws, and devour them with their serpent end. There is no use of the term Lamia here, but there are three justifications for us construing these monsters as Lamiae. First, the Libyan setting. Secondly, the overall congruence in configuration with Statius's monster. And thirdly, the monster's taste for devouring young men, which is strongly congruent with the Lamias of the following two case studies that I'll mention. This hunting technique is not unlike the actual one of the spider-tailed Persian horned viper. It camouflages itself against a rock whilst wiggling around an uncannily spider-like tassel on the end of its tail. When the bird comes to take it, the snake head wheels round, and I do encourage you to Google this. As I say, it's the spider-tailed Persian horned viper. It's absolutely uncanny. You might not be convinced by the spider there, but it's breathtaking when seen in motion. Anyway, right. Antoninus Liberalis derives a fascinating tale from the circa 200 BC Heteroeumena of Menander. Sorry, of Nicander. According to this, the Delphians were subject to random marauding attacks from a monster called Lamia, really called Lamia this time, or Sybaris, that lived on Mount Surface near Delphi. They were driven to the point of uprooting their city, but Apollo told them they could be delivered if they sacrificed a citizen lad to the creature. The lot fell upon the fair Alcyoneus as he was being led off. Eurybatus happened on the scene and fell in love with the victim. He took his garlands on his own head and had himself taken to the monster in his place. He dragged her from the cave and threw her down the mountainside, whereupon she disappeared and the spring, called Sybaris, appeared in her place. In due course, the colony of Sybaris was named from this spring. Evidently, the monster was first and foremost a Lamia, with the additional name of Sybaris serving only the purposes of etiology. But what form did she take? Antoninus says nothing, but a clue is provided by Pausanias's closely congruent story of Mnestratus. This tells that the city of Thespiae was similarly beset by a marauding dracone. Apollo advised that the beast could be brought under a certain degree of control if an ephebe, chosen by lot, was sacrificed to it every year. One year, the lot fell upon Cleostratus. So his lover, Mnestratus, devised a plan. He had a bronze breastplate made covered in fish hooks and fed himself to the creature in Cleostratus' place. On being devoured, he twisted and turned and so ripped the creature apart from the inside, albeit dying himself too in the process. The comparison makes it likely that the surface Lamia was indeed some sort of serpent at least, though admittedly it cannot be proven that she was an anguipede. Philostratus tells the well-known tale of Apollonius of Tyana's encounter with a creature defined as a phasma, a lamia, and an empusa in Corinth. This episode serves as a model for John Keats' major poem, Lamia, of 1820, and through it also for some fine Edwardian paintings by Waterhouse, in fact two from him, Annalia Merritt, who we saw before, and Herbert Draper. The creature manifests herself as a beautiful Phoenician woman and seduces Apollonius's handsome pupil Menippus into marrying her, with a view to feeding him fat and eating him. She is unmasked by the sage at the wedding feast. He observes that the splendid decorations of the feast are all illusory, whilst the woman herself is a snake, an office. We are given no more details. Clearly, the creature contrives to combine woman with serpent in some form. It could be, since she is able to cast hallucinations on people, that we should think of her in reality a pure serpent with the power to project herself as a humanoid woman. Such an interpretation might suit the application of the word phasma, apparition, to her. Another alternative is that she is a pure serpent with the power to transform herself fully into humanoid form. A model for such a transformation is provided by Apuleius's marvellous story of the massive old serpent that is able to transform himself into an appropriately bent old man in order to trick a runaway slave into accompanying him to a private place where he can revert to his devout form and devour him. But it is also possible that we are to imagine this creature to be an anguipede. The application of the further term empusa to the creature might invite us to think so. An ancient folk etymology of this derived it from hen and pus, one foot, signifying a creature that went on one foot. And compare again here Lucian's description of his anguipede Hecate as going on a dracone foot, draconteoi podi. We might also be invited to think of her as an anguipede by a potential congruence with the narrative of the narrative with Dio's material. Both sets of creatures seduce desirable young men with their attractive female humanoid forms before devouring them. Might Philostratus' creature conceal her serpentine lower half beneath her skirts, a la Melusine? The serpentine element of the Lamia has to be looked for hard, but it is evidently ancient and integral, for the Lamia derives from the ancient Mesopotamian child-killing demoness Lamashtu, of whom, for example, 1st millennium BC Akkadian texts tell that she brandishes serpents in her hands. And indeed, she is shown to do this precisely in the famous relief of her from Carchemish. Nearly done. Campi. Apollodorus tells us, after the Eumelian Titanomachy, that Campi was a monster deployed to keep guard over the Cyclopes imprisoned in Tartarus. We heard about these before. Zeus slew her to release them when he needed them to manufacture thunderbolts for him during the Titanomachy. Diodorus tells that she was an earthborn monster that terrorized the Libyan city of Zabirna, the Libyan connection as we have with Lamia, and that she was slain by Dionysus, again in some sort of loose association with the Titanomachy. It's not until Nonnus, if that's not beyond the pale, that we get a full-blown physical description of her, and she's revealed to be an anguipede. Here we learn that she is of vast size. Her principal head and torso are those of a woman, with the scales of a Katos, a sea monster, down from her chest. Her hair consists of venomous Dracontes. Her legs consist of 1,000 coiling vipers. 50 animal heads project from around her neck, including those of lions, boars, and dogs, inviting comparison with both the Sphinx and Scylla. Her arms end in curving talons. A scorpion tail arches over her head, and she is a black-winged nymph of Tartarus, and rouses storms with her wings. She shoots fire from her eyes. That's a bit snaky too, perhaps. We might in any case have guessed her anguiform nature. Her life in Tartarus is reminiscent of the Hesiodic Echidna, whilst her name consists of a Greek word signifying caterpillar or silkworm, an ironic litotes, no doubt. So, to conclude, the word Dracaena was not plainly and simply the female equivalent of the dracone. On occasion, the word could indeed fulfil such a function, but in practice it almost always connoted a female serpent in some sort of association with a woman or human or a humanoid female. In particular, it seems to have served as a specialised term for female anguipedes. The female anguipedes, for all their numbers and their lurking continuity, never seem to have occupied the centre ground of Greek mythology, let alone of Greek divinity, but ever to have been somewhat occluded, to have belonged indeed to another crowd. The greatest act of occlusion comes in the iconographic realm. To the best of my knowledge, yeah, Diana's going to prove me wrong, I'm sure. To the best of my knowledge, there are only two extant images of female anguipedes in ancient art, and I've shown you them already, the Hecate Lekythos and the Lamia Lekythos. The latter further occluded by the world of scholarship that has conspired to mislabel her as Python. There is occlusion too in the mythographic realm, with a tradition of the female anguipede Delphic serpent, Delphine, being almost entirely smothered by the rival tradition of the male Delphic serpent, Python. And the female anguipedes also suffer from a curious phenomenon that I'm tempted to term diffraction. This is particularly visible in the cases of Echidna and Lamia. Echidna, or at any rate a creature of this name, of anguipede form, manifests herself in at least three different contexts in ancient tradition in such a way as to leave us wondering whether we're dealing with one creature or three. Is Herodotus' brood Scythian Echidna to be identified with Hesiod's underworld brood mother? And what of the acts of Philip's mother of snakes Echidna? Lamia presents an even more complex case. Even the broad category to which she belongs is unstable. Is she a mythical heroine? Like the other lovers of Zeus, is she a ghost? Is she a child-killing demon? Is she a voracious flesh-and-blood monster? Does she attack babies? Does she attack handsome young men? Then again, amongst the specifically anguiform Lamias, we seem to lack fixed ground. What is the relationship between the anguipede Lamia that attacked Argos, and was she killed by Choroibos? What is the relationship between the anguipede Lamia that attacked Argos and was killed by Choroibos, and the Lamia, probably also anguipede, that attacked Delphi and was killed by Eurybates? Despite the fact that both die in their own stories, are they one and the same? What is the relationship between both of these and the Lamia unmasked in Corinth by Apollonius of Tyana? Was she an anguipede too, or was she rather a serpent with the power to mutate her form into a humanoid one when convenient, like Apuleius' old man, Draco? Or, given that she is described as a phasma, was she rather a serpent with the power to project a humanoid hallucination? And what was the relationship between all three of these individual lamias and the quasi wild animal race of the lamias living in Libya, of which Diochrysostom speaks so entertainingly in a sort of natural historical mode? Many questions, but few answers. Thank you.